Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the October 7th, 2022 issue of the Week. The cover drawing this week is a outer space scene. In the foreground is a giant asteroid. In the background, you can see the Earth and its moon. And on the surface of the asteroid is some sort of explosion. The headline is, A Nudge in Time. NASA's test of its plan to save humanity from an extinction event. And that's one of two shorter main stories that we're going to start with today. NASA tests space defense with asteroid collision. What happened? NASA completed a planetary defense test against a mass extinction event this week by crashing a small spacecraft into an egg-shaped asteroid called Dimorphos to nudge it into a new orbit. It will take 2 months to determine if the crash of the refrigerator-sized spacecraft at 14,000 miles per hour successfully shifted the asteroid into a new course, with astronomers using telescopes on all seven continents to chart its path. Located about 7 million miles from Earth, Dimorphos is 525 feet across and orbits a larger asteroid, Didymos, part of NASA's Double Asteroid Redirection Test, DART. The $300 mission is the first step of a program to develop the means to deflect asteroids and comets that could cause massive damage or even wipe out human civilization if they hit Earth. Neither Dimorphos or Didymos posed a threat, but NASA targeted them to test its ability to divert an asteroid in the future. Collisions between Earth and asteroids large enough to cause planet-wide destruction, such as the one that rendered dinosaurs extinct, only occur every 10 million years, and over 90% of large near-Earth objects have already been discovered. But smaller asteroids, like Dimorphos, are far more numerous. NASA has identified about 29,000, of which a few thousand are potentially hazardous. Upon impact, they're capable of releasing more energy than a nuclear bomb. As far as we can tell, our first planetary defense test was a success, said Elena Adams, the mission systems engineer. She said that scientists who observed the collision simultaneously experienced both terror and joy. What the columnist said. Whoever thought crashing into space rocks could be so useful to the defense of humanity, asked Ray Paletta in the Washington Post. And yet, this mission has serious implications. 9 years ago, a small asteroid exploded above west central Russia. 100 years earlier, a much bigger one burst over Siberia, flattening hundreds of square miles of forest. The prospect of this occurring again over a populated area is fundamentally terrifying because it's out of our control. Deflecting asteroids is ambitious work, but saving the world is worth the effort. Beyond potentially saving human civilization, the DART mission may accomplish something else, reminding NASA skeptics that there's good reason to support an ample budget for the space agency, said Quinn Hillier in the Washington Examiner. There are some things that private companies like Elon Musk's SpaceX just won't do, like putting saving humankind at the top of their list of priorities. But NASA, properly managed, is a good investment. Regardless, the success of DART doesn't mean we're safe from asteroid strikes, said Stephen Carter in Bloomberg. A real threat of an object hitting Earth just might arise with little notice, perhaps just weeks or days. For this test mission, we had, in effect, all the time in the world to plan the experiment and carry it out. There's still reason to celebrate, but will it work when space debris is actually headed our way? We'll never know for sure until we're forced to try. Iranians burn hijabs in nationwide protests. What happened? Thousands of Iranians took to the streets this week, burning headscarves and shouting, "Death to the dictator," in the most serious challenge to the country's theocratic regime in years. The protest, sparked by the death of a 22-year-old woman detained by the morality police, spread to all 31 of Iran's provinces. Mahsa Amini, a Kurdish woman arrested in Tehran and sent to a re-education center for wearing her headscarf loosely, died on September 16th in police custody. Iranian authorities blamed her death on a heart attack, but witnesses said police had beaten her, and CT scan images reportedly showed signs of skull fracture. Police had responded with live ammunition, clubs, and tear gas, killing at least 76 protesters, including a young woman who appeared in a viral video tying her unscarved hair back and stepping into a protest, and arresting at least 1,200 more. This week, authorities blamed the unrest on the enemies of the Islamic Republic and threatened to crack down with all their might. To block protesters from communicating, the Iranian government choked off cell phone service, throttled internet speeds, and blocked VPN services and messaging apps such as WhatsApp and Instagram. In response, the Biden administration relaxed restrictions on U.S. companies seeking to give Iranians tools for internet access and put sanctions on more Iranian officials. President Biden expressed U.S. solidarity with the brave citizens and the brave women of Iran, protesting to secure their basic rights. What the columnist said. Amini's death has set off an earthquake, said the Economist, and tapped into a deep well of grievances. Iranians, especially women, are fed up with the slate of religious rules imposed by aging clerics and enforced with increasing severity after hardline President Ebrahim Raisi took over last year. Thanks to economic mismanagement and U.S. sanctions, the economy is a mess, with inflation soaring over 50%. Iranians increasingly feel they have nothing to lose. The U.S. can help them, said Eric Mandel in The Hill. The Obama administration chose to sit on the sidelines during 2009's pro-democracy mass protest, and while Biden has been more proactive, he must do more. He should double down on sanctioning Iranian human rights abusers, implement secondary sanctions on abettors such as China, and finally abandon efforts to revive the flawed 2015 nuclear agreement. Regime change should be an American foreign policy goal. The uprising will probably be put down just as ruthlessly as earlier protests, said Jason Rezaian in the Washington Post. Still, this era of dissent will not fade anytime soon. The U.S. should welcome Iranian dissidents seeking to flee and work with Iranian diaspora to further destabilize the region. Help may come too late for today's wave of resistance, but the U.S. needs to be ready to help the next one and the one after that. Controversy of the week. Trump, are the walls closing in? For most people, being accused of staggering fraud by the New York Attorney General would be a terribly ominous development, said Steve Vladek in CNN.com. For Donald Trump last week, it wasn't even the worst legal news he received. First, New York Attorney General Tisha James unveiled her $250 million lawsuit against Trump and three of his children, Don Jr., Ivanka, and Eric, for allegedly inflating the family's assets and applying for loans and reducing them when paying taxes. Then the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals reversed key portions of Judge Eileen Cannon's controversial ruling in the Mar-a-Lago documents case, allowing the Justice Department to resume its criminal investigation of the removal of at least 100 classified documents to Trump's Mar-a-Lago estate. In withering language, the panel of three judges, including two Trump appointees, dismissed as a red herring Trump's claims in interviews that he had declassified everything, which Trump said a president could do even by thinking about it. Trump's choice as special master to review the documents, Judge Raymond Deary, was no less contemptuous, said Dara Gregorian and NBCNews.com. The no-nonsense Deary told the former president's lawyers to provide evidence in court that any documents had been declassified or planted by the FBI, or as far as I'm concerned, that's the end of it. Throughout his life, Trump has shown a remarkable capacity to survive situations that seem dire, said Eric Tucker in the Associated Press. That includes innumerable lawsuits, multiple accusations of sexual assault, the Mueller investigation, and two impeachments. But his Houdini Act may be coming to an end. He is facing not only major charges in the document investigation, including possible violations of the Espionage Act and the civil fraud case in New York, but also a DOJ investigation of his role in the January 6th insurrection and another investigation in Georgia for pressuring election officials on tape to falsify vote totals. Court is Trump's kryptonite, said Jonathan Last in The Bulwark. In real estate or politics, people blessed with the gift of shamelessness can lie their way out of trouble. In a courtroom lies backfire, and the evidence is what it matters. If you're proven guilty, bluster won't help. Men with guns will drag you off to prison. Yes, it looks bad for Trump, said Andrew Prokop in Vox. But are the walls really closing in? Allegations aren't proof, and indicting a former president for the first time in U.S. history is so fraught that prosecutors will need to be reasonably certain they can get a conviction. Even if Trump is charged with crimes, the ensuing trials and appeals could take years. So if Trump wants to run for president again in 2024, he probably can, since the Trumpified Republican base has swallowed his claim that he's the victim of a massive partisan witch hunt. As a conservative Republican, I fervently hope he does not run, said Andrew McCarthy in National Republic. Trump's claim in the document case that he could magically declassify top secret documents is laughably stupid, not even a defense at all. Trump will be so damaged by this case and others that Democrats will want him on the ballot in 2024. He might win the GOP nomination, but there's no chance he'll win the general election. What that means, strangely enough, is that if Biden's Justice Department indicts Trump, it is doing Republicans a big favor. It was a good week for draft dodging, with reports that Russian men were breaking their limbs to avoid being conscripted into the Ukraine war. Google reported a surge in searches for how to break an arm at home. It was a good week for believing your client with the news that Johnny Depp is dating Joelle Rich, the lawyer who represented him in his failed 2018 libel lawsuit against the UK tabloid The Sun, which had referred to him as a wife beater. It was a good week for Representative Matt Gaetz, who will reportedly not be charged with a crime after the Justice Department concluded that the key witnesses in its sex trafficking investigation, Gaetz's friend Joel Greenberg, would not be a credible witness because he's already pleaded guilty to sex trafficking and other crimes. But it was a bad week for extremism, with new AI analysis of 4 billion tweets that found that people send 22% more hate tweets when the temperature climbs above 70 degrees and 12% more when it drops below 54 degrees. It was a bad week for Rudy Giuliani, who may complete his epic fall from grace with a stint in jail for unpaid alimony. Giuliani, 78, allegedly owes $260,000 to ex-wife Judith. "I'm being sued in 10 different cases," Giuliani complained to the judge. Finally, it was a bad week for winning after an Indian man named Anoop complained that ever since he won the 250 million rupees, $3.08 million, in a lottery, people won't stop asking him for money. "I can't leave the house. I can't go anywhere," says Anoop. "I wish I hadn't won." And a short and other news piece. Student loan plan could cost $400 billion. President Biden's plan to erase thousands of dollars of student loan debt for about 40 million Americans could cost $400 billion over the next 30 years, the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office said this week. An extension of the pause on federal student loan repayments through December will cost an additional $20 billion, the CBO said. An executive order that lowers payments for borrowers in income-based plans could add another $120 billion, according to an outside estimate. The numbers reignited GOP attacks on the loan plans, which take effect later this year. 60% of borrowers are expected to see their debt reduced by the maximum $20,000, the White House says, and half could see their debt canceled entirely. On the briefing page, the asylum seekers. Many migrants coming to the U.S. border are now legally applying for asylum, creating a backlog of 660,000 cases. What is asylum? It is an immigration category for people who face threats in their home countries. The Refugee Act of 1980, which was based on United Nations protocols the U.S. had previously signed, officially authorized the admission to the U.S. of people fleeing persecution or a well-founded fear of persecution on account of race, religion, nationality, membership in a particular social group, or political opinion. Since that legal definition of persecution was established, federal officials have expanded it to include gang violence, homophobic repression, and forced abortion under China's one-child policy. Most migrants now arriving at the U.S. southern border come from Central America, a region plagued by lawlessness, extreme poverty, and drug-related gang violence. Another growing share of refugees are fleeing repressive socialist regimes in Cuba, Nicaragua, and Venezuela, including most of the 50 migrants Florida Governor Ron DeSantis recently flew to Martha's Vineyard. Most asylum seekers cannot have their claims quickly processed at the border and are released into the U.S. to await legal proceedings. There is now a backlog of more than 660,000 cases, and it can take 4 or more years for claims to be heard. "The system," said former U.S. Immigration Chief Doris Meisner, "is deeply broken." How does the process work? Migrants first undergo a credible fear interview in which they explain the nature and severity of the threats they face if deported. Migrants who pass that interview can apply for asylum and move on to the next stage, the asylum merits interview. Failure to clear both rounds triggers the deportation process, though a migrant has multiple chances to appeal. Asylum applications can either be affirmative, at the applicant's first contact with immigration authorities, or defensive, usually after a migrant has been apprehended by Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Asylum seekers are generally held in detention centers or monitored through electronic devices with frequent required check-ins. Do most claims succeed? No. Last year, judges denied 63% of asylum claims. Acceptance and denial rates vary dramatically among judges and jurisdictions. While more than half of asylum applications are approved in some New York immigration courts, in Atlanta's, at least 97% are denied. Judges have discretion in deciding whether the migrant has demonstrated with substantial evidence that coming to the U.S. was the only way to escape persecution. That standard can be difficult to meet, especially if the applicant is not a legally oppressed minority or the persecutor is a non-state actor such as a gang or abusive husband. Some claims fail on their case's merits, others on technicalities, such as paperwork error or a missed hearing. Migrants are not provided lawyers, and those representing themselves usually lose their cases. What was Trump's asylum policy? His administration sought to discourage and block asylum claims. In 2018, Customs and Border Protection introduced the Remain in Mexico program, which forced overland asylum seekers to wait south of the border, mostly in squalid tent cities and shelters plagued by disease and violence. In March 2020, the administration cited COVID to invoke Title 42, a 1944 public health directive that allows border agents to deny entry and immediately deport migrants coming from areas with outbreaks of infectious disease. More than 2 million instant expulsions have taken place under Title 42. During his presidential campaign, Joe Biden promised to end Trump's detrimental asylum policies and ensure the dignity of migrants. What has Biden done? After a long court battle, his administration terminated Remain in Mexico in June. It has also loosened Title 42's restrictions, but a court ruling in May prevented it from being lifted entirely. A pilot program announced in March will surge asylum officers to the border so that cases can be decided within 90 days, but it hasn't been widely implemented yet. During Biden's tenure, more than 1 million migrants have been temporarily allowed into the U.S., while 1.7 million were turned away at the borders, further overwhelming the country's immigration bureaucracy. Are there other solutions? The Biden administration has been working with countries in the Western Hemisphere to tackle the root causes of migration, but the violence, corruption, and economic instability in countries such as El Salvador and Honduras will not be easily improved. Conservatives argue that the U.S. should have a stricter standard for asylum that excludes factors such as violent crime and poverty. Otherwise, they say tens of millions of people in this hemisphere would qualify for asylum, an influx far too large for the U.S. to handle. Progressives contend that granting asylum is a humanitarian imperative and potential economic boon for a country with major shortages of low-skilled workers in many industries. Nearly everyone agrees that the U.S. immigration system is in dire need of a major overhaul. Meanwhile, asylum seekers like Andre Fernandez await decisions about whether they can stay. Fernandez said he made the arduous journey from Venezuela to pursue the American dream, which is to work hard and lift your back. His first hearing will be in March 2024. Moving into the best columns of the week, we'll start with two from the U.S. A grim ending for COVID. If this is the end of COVID, then it's far worse than we imagined, said Sarah Zhang. Most Americans are foregoing masks and resuming normal activities, and President Biden has declared the pandemic over. But every day there are still tens of thousands of new infections and an average of 400 people dying from COVID. This is not how most of us envisioned the end of the pandemic when vaccines arrived in 2021. After the virus began rapidly mutating to elude immunity from vaccination and prior infection, we hoped it might morph into an illness like the common cold, or pessimistically, the flu. But COVID has settled into something far worse. Virologists estimate that COVID will continue to kill 100,000 Americans annually in the coming years, three times the average number of flu deaths. As it continues to rapidly mutate, COVID might continue to infect 50% of the population every year, compared with 10 to 20% for the flu. Some will be left with long COVID. For people over 65 and those with conditions like diabetes, cancer, and obesity, COVID will continue to pose a serious, ever-present threat. With a public weary of pandemic measures and a government reluctant to push them, that's what over seems to mean. Why we're so divided on immigration. When Florida Governor Ron DeSantis recently flew 50 migrants to Martha's Vineyard, said Bonnie Christian, progressives were repulsed by what they saw as an unscrupulous exploitation of desperate people. Conservatives, however, saw the stunt as a necessary way to draw attention to a national crisis. Why is there such a gulf in perception about immigration? On a basic level, conservatives generally prefer order and feel an instinctive unease when they see tens of thousands of people overwhelming border officials and streaming into the country. This is indeed a crisis to them, and they feel that something must be done about this now. By nature, progressives are more comfortable with change and disorder and see the flood of new arrivals in terms of social justice, freedom, and the American dream. But people on the left need to understand that the automatic discomfort many Americans feel about the chaos at the border cannot be waved away as irrelevant. If the constant, uncontrolled influx of migrants continues, any kind of comprehensive immigration reform will be impossible, and there will be a deeply felt need in American politics that some politicians will be happy to exploit. This is an international column from Russia. Exodus as Russians flee the military call-up. Packed airports, sold-out trains, lines of cars and scooters stretching for miles. President Vladimir Putin's announcement last week of a mobilization of reservists sent thousands of Russians racing for the borders, said T. Kutsilava in Ambebi. Nearly half a million had already bolted the country soon after Russia's February 24 invasion of Ukraine, and now neighboring nations like Finland, Georgia, and Kazakhstan are seeing a new influx. A day after Putin's announcement, the Georgian border was chaos, as Russian guards were blocking men from leaving. Some of those who stayed told me they planned to refuse service, saying they would be better off in prison than in Ukraine. But that might not be an option. Many of the few thousand demonstrators who dared to protest the call-up last week weren't sent to jail, but instead were shipped straight to the military. The only safe way to hide is to emigrate. So much for partial mobilization, said Antonia Asanova in Novaya Gazeta. The Kremlin at first claimed it would call up some 300,000 men, but our sources told us that a secret clause in the decree authorizes drafting 1 million. And while Putin said only men with prior military service qualified, some of those who got the first draft notices had never served at all, while others last saw service decades ago. In Buryatia, in Siberia, where a third of the population are indigenous Buryats, recruiters rousted men out of bed at midnight, giving them just an hour to pack and no chance to flee. That was no accident. Ethnic minorities are being disproportionately targeted. In Crimea, for example, some 90% of those called up were Crimean Tatars, and rural regions are required to send many times more recruits proportionally than major cities. One minority, though, is claiming to be exempt, said Nadia Klotchko in Glavkom. Chechen leader Ramzan Kadyrov said the mobilization would not apply to his province because too many Chechens had already died in Ukraine. That's because Kadyrov, long a key Putin ally, recruited some 8,000 Chechens as paid mercenaries and sent them to fight for Russia. Most didn't come back, and Kadyrov knows that if he tried to call up any more, defiant Chechens would simply shoot the military commissar and retreat to the mountains. The Chechen strongman's open revolt against mobilization is a sign that Putin's rule is growing shaky. For now, the refuseniks are a small minority of those called up, said Walter Himmerl in Wiener Zeitung. But what if the trickle turns into a stream of refugees? European leaders are bickering about whether to let them in. After all, there's no general right to asylum for those evading conscription. And the tiny Baltic states fear that Russia could slip spies and saboteurs in among the draft dodgers. Europe has already accepted more than 5 million Ukrainians since the war began. If the increasingly unstable Putin grows more radical, we could see our second refugee crisis inside a year. Time for the last word, our feature article. We are going to shoot your child. When Russian soldiers occupied her town, said Yulia Petrova in Meduza.io, residents stood and cried. Then a neighbor denounced her, and the soldiers came for Yulia and her family. The three of us lived together. Me, my mom, and my daughter. We were all home when the war started, and we were afraid. We got a call from our relatives in Kharkiv, and they told us the war had begun. You could already hear explosions and aircraft flying overhead. We immediately went down to the basement. We brought our animals down there, too. We currently have more than 20. Some of them were scared of the loud noises and hid. Russian troops entered our village almost immediately. They came in without a fight. There weren't any Ukrainian soldiers here, and the mayor, Gennady Mastagora, gave up the city. That was the beginning of our 6 months of occupation. They came in right away and stationed their vehicles in front of the village council. Local residents soon began to assemble there to protest against them. But they acted like they owned the place. In the first few days, they hung up flags everywhere, Russian and Soviet ones. They put a Russian soldier at every intersection. They didn't have any contact with the locals. They were all standoffish. Nobody could say anything to them. From the very beginning, they started taking people's businesses from them. In the bazaars and markets, they would take over people's booths. They were like that when they went shopping, too. You couldn't look them in the eyes. They took whatever they wanted from the stalls. And if you dared to talk back to them, or if they were simply in a bad mood, they would beat you and take you to the basement. They took whatever they wanted from people. They went into apartments and just stole what they liked. They took over entire buildings. They would take people's cars. The best case scenario was them just pulling the owners out of the front seat. Basically, they acted like the world belonged to them. Sometimes they would get drunk and drive their APCs, armored personnel carriers, around with their machine guns. One time, one of them climbed out of the hatch with his gun at the bus station and said, "I'm about to shoot you in the legs." just like that to people standing there. They would fire at apartment buildings for their own entertainment. That kind of thing happened a lot. Local residents were also found dead in a river with bags over their heads and their arms bound with tape. I heard about that from some local fishermen back at the start of the summer. They were fishing on the Osco River when a corpse floated to the surface. Nobody dared to remove the bag from the person's head. Instead, they called the commandant's office. Some soldiers came, along with divers, and they silently retrieved the body and took it away. Awful things happened in the basements of the administration buildings as well. They would detain people there. Whenever you walked by, your hair would stand on end because you could hear the inhuman screams, both women's and men's voices. It's scary even to imagine what they did to make people scream like that. A lot of people we knew who didn't hide their pro-Ukrainian views ended up disappearing. We still don't know where they are. Mykola Masly, who went to the protest, is still missing. A lot of young women disappeared too. Where are they? Nobody knows. A lot of bad things happened. There were also people in the village who supported them. Some of them went to the Luhansk and Donetsk regions, then continued on to Russia. Most of them were old, but there were a lot of young people, too. Basically, none of this bothered them. They were so nostalgic. They would say, pretty soon, we'll be earning good money. The railroad will start working like it did in Soviet times. In my apartment building, for example, one woman started working in their headquarters. She would say Ukraine is bad, and these guys were good. Look on the internet at the village of Kupiansk-Vluslovye on May 9th. How they waved Russian flags and rejoiced. And we stood there and cried. In the first days, they gathered to work on the railroad. They said they needed to reestablish a railway route to Russia. At first, they promised everybody high salaries. Then once they'd fooled people, they started promising less. They brought in everything they needed, transported equipment in from Russia, and didn't end up paying anybody at all. They gave people food rations instead of paychecks and told them they wouldn't be getting any money and that if you didn't come to work, they'd come find you and deal with you. So people started working for free. Meanwhile, they raised the prices of everything threefold. The prices were insane. People found themselves on the brink of starvation. Then there were the denunciations. My friend's mom, who works as a caretaker, for example, said to me, "Why are you supporting Ukraine? I can go right now and give you up to the Russians, and you'll end up in the basement." There was nothing I could say, because once you're in the basement, there's no getting out. And if you do get out, it's with serious injuries. A son of some friends of mine missed the curfew by just a few minutes. He wasn't home in time. They took him and put him in the basement. The next day, they took him out. They had beaten him so badly that he couldn't walk. It must have been someone's denunciation that made them come for me, too. Someone told them about my views that I opposed them, probably one of my neighbors. Three people showed up. One of them immediately shoved me and I fell over. They pulled me to the sofa in the kitchen. They sat me down and started going through our phones. One person searched the phone while the other searched the apartment. They were looking for Ukrainian symbols and that kind of thing. I don't have anything like that, but they turned the whole apartment upside down looking. Eventually, they aimed their guns at me and my daughter and reloaded them. They shouted, "We're going to shoot your child. Tell us right now, where are your flags, bitch? You support Ukraine, right? You don't like us? You don't like Russians?" I just stayed silent. I was so scared. I couldn't say a single word. They searched and searched until finally they said, "We'll be back," and left. The next day, August 22nd, we found someone who had a car, and he drove us out. We didn't take our things with us because we couldn't carry them. All we took were the oldest and most unhealthy cats. We put them in a special carrying case, two in each, and used the last of our money to get out of there. We had to pass by 9 Russian checkpoints on our way to Ukraine. The road to the line of demarcation between Ukrainian and Russian troops took 6 hours. It was hard going through all those checkpoints. Each soldier there had his own triggers, and you always had to find an approach that would keep him from shooting you. We had to give them money so they wouldn't harm us. They think they own us because they decide who can pass through and who can't. Their leader was posted at the 8th checkpoint, the second to last. They led us up to him so he could decide whether to let us pass or not. That's where they do the official, most thorough check. They don't let everyone through, but in general, if you pay, you can continue on. Although even that's not always true. Some friends told me that they sometimes even refuse to let people through who've paid. It probably depends who's on shift. But we paid them to let us through. They took all of our gold, including my daughter's gold cross and chain, and we gave them $400 that we'd been saving for a rainy day, so to speak. But even so, if you want to pass, you have to completely wipe your phone, because they can restore your messages and photos. You have to either have a brand new phone or delete all of your accounts and restore your phone to factory settings, because they'll always find a way to get you otherwise. We made it to the unoccupied part of the Kharkiv region. It was thanks, of course, to Ukrainian soldiers and volunteers. They really help everyone. They helped us with our pets, too. All of those baskets were hard to carry. They helped us load them and unload them. And by about 1 p.m., we were already in a filtration camp, a Ukrainian one. It's a building with Ukrainian soldiers and the Ukrainian Security Service, the SBU. First, they fed everyone. Medical aid was given to anyone who needed it. While we waited to be interviewed, they gave our cats some water and looked after them for us. We were interviewed by SBU officers. They asked about our life under occupation, whether we were abused, that kind of thing. They checked our phone to make sure there wasn't anything there. That's understandable. A lot of collaborators and traitors leave too. But it wasn't really anything you could call an interrogation, more of a conversation. We spoke with them briefly, then they released us. They called us a taxi. Overall, it was fine. At first, it was really difficult to get used to the fact that we didn't have to be scared around soldiers anymore, because they were our guys, Ukrainian soldiers. We'd gotten used to lowering our eyes. We weren't allowed to look at the Russians. There was no telling what reaction it would provoke. Somebody looked at them and nobody spoke to them. But now, when we see Ukrainian soldiers, it actually calms us down. We don't get nervous and start twitching like we did back at home. We're at peace. We're slowly getting back to normal. The trip has been hard on our pets, of course. We've had problems finding a place to live. Most landlords don't want you to have 6 cats. At first, we stayed with an elderly couple, both of whom were disabled. We lived with them in a tiny little house. Then we heard through the grapevine about a small house in a village. We don't have any clothes except the ones on our backs. But our main priority right now is getting hold of our other pets. Kupiansk has been liberated. But just yesterday, there was shelling from the Russian Federation, and there were some casualties. There's no cell service there, and I still have a lot of pets there. One of our neighbors is looking after them. I really want to go home, but I can't right now. Our village is located right next to the border. All their artillery will be able to reach our house, and their missiles will be flying overhead. I'll go back. My pets are there, and my home is there, but not anytime soon. I'm not a military expert, but I think the Russians are going to try to take the city back. Because we have a railway junction connecting railroads going 5 different directions, and it's strategically important. All of this needs to change. The war needs to come to an end. I really want to believe that's what will happen. I want it all to be over. I want people to stop dying and stop being crippled. I don't want people or animals to have to suffer any longer. This article was originally published by Meduza, M-E-D-U-Z-A. We'll read a couple of these short health and science articles today. Quadrillions of ants. Anyone who's had a picnic won't be surprised to learn that ants outnumber humans, but the staggering size of that differential, 2.5 million to 1, may come as a shock. In the most thorough count yet, researchers in Hong Kong and Germany have estimated the total number of ants in the world, including both tree-dwelling and ground-dwelling ants, as 20 quadrillion. That's the equivalent of 1 trillion times 20,000. And it's probably an underestimate, reports CBC.ca. The researchers compiled and analyzed nearly 500 studies from many countries that used a variety of methods to track ant populations. One method collected 1 square meter of sample leaf litter, extracted the ants from it, and then scaled up to estimate the number of ants on the global surface. Another used pitfall traps, counted the ants that fell in, and then extrapolated to estimate larger populations. The ubiquitous insects have been around since dinosaurs roamed the earth. The oldest known ant fossil dates back to the Cretaceous period, about 100 million years ago. And now their total biomass is greater than the mass of all birds and wild mammals combined. I'm stunned, said lead author Sabine Newton, an insect ecologist in Germany. It's incredibly difficult to comprehend. It's amazingly awesome as well. Neptune like never before. NASA has used the James Webb Space Telescope to get the clearest visuals of Neptune in more than 3 decades, and the images reveal surprising new details. Astronomers already knew that the icy planet had bright, narrow rings, but the new images also depict fainter dust rings, reports The Atlantic. Unlike the Hubble Space Telescope, whose instruments picked up mostly visible light and made Neptune appear blue, the Webb uses a near-infrared camera that makes the planet itself look almost luminescent and captures the rings crisply. I was yelling, making my kids, my mom, even my cats look, says Heidi Hamel, a NASA scientist and vice president of the Association of Universities for Research in Astronomy. Presumably the cats didn't know Neptune had rings either. The images from Webb, which is 100 times more powerful than Hubble, also show Neptune's high-altitude methane ice clouds as thin lights of light on the surface, and 7 of the planet's 14 moons. And we'll flip over to the Talking Points page. Judge, home runs without asterisks. Forget what the record books say, said Matt Calkins in the Seattle Times. If New York Yankees slugger Aaron Judge keeps blasting home runs, he should be considered baseball's single-season home run king. When the week went to press, Judge had hit a remarkable 60 homers this season, one shy of the American League record set by another Yankee outfielder, Roger Maris, in 1961. Mark McGwire and Sammy Sosa hit 70 and 66 home runs, respectively, in 1998, and Barry Bonds hit 73 homers in 2001. The joy of watching those hulking sluggers chase one of America's most sacrosanct records was soon marred by strong evidence that they were using performance-enhancing steroids. Players are now routinely tested, and Judge is clean. If he hits number 62, it will be his historic achievement, with no mental asterisk attached. Judge is a baseball player, as Michelangelo might have conceived of one, said David Von Drell in the Washington Post. The statuesque outfielder, 30, is a V-shaped 6'7" and packs his Yankee pinstripes with 282 pounds of lean muscle. His compact swing lashes pitches with cobra quickness, launching homers with the power of a howitzer. What a breath of fresh air, said Matthew Hennessy in the Wall Street Journal. Many fans were turned off by the steroid scandals and the impression that today's stars are overpaid prima donnas. But most of baseball is rooting for Judge. In addition to smashing the cover off the ball, he hustles, plays stellar defense, and is by all accounts a great, unselfish teammate. With each home run, Judge is restoring baseball's purity. The anticipation whenever Judge steps to the plate recently is palpable, said Larry Fischer in Forbes. At Yankee Stadium, fans have been standing in eerie silence for every pitch, bringing Judge's All Rise nickname to life. But while Judge stirs the hearts of the sports romantics, said Mike Vaccaro in the New York Post, the excitement is simply not the same as in 1998. When McGuire's and Sosa's superhuman slugging captured the world's attention. The revelation that it was a fraud perpetrated by drug-taking cheats drained much of the joy and the wonder from home run hitting itself. As spectacular as Judge's season has been, our innocence has been lost, and it's impossible to bring it back. And a side note on this article, I heard this morning on the news that, in fact, Aaron Judge hit his 62nd home run of the season just last night. Midterms, the GOP's policy promises. Congressional Republicans have put forward a positive and focused vision that gives voters a stark choice in the midterm elections, said Quinn Hillier in the Washington Examiner. House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy last week unveiled GOP's commitment to America, which he described as a bold conservative vision for Republican policies if they regain control of the House and possibly the Senate. The plan calls for expanding domestic fossil fuel production, halting catch-and-release immigration policies, cutting government spending, and fighting crime. It also promises to fight inflation, defend gun rights, and promote parental control over schools. McCarthy has the party's priorities right, said Cal Thomas in the Washington Times. Voters are worried about an uncontrolled border, violent crime, and a cultural fabric that seems to many conservatives to be falling apart. McCarthy's manifesto is not so much a platform as a one-page list of slogans, said Karen Tumulty in the Washington Post. It's an obvious attempt to duplicate Representative Newt Gingrich's Contract with America, whose 1994 release preceded a dramatic House takeover. But Gingrich's contract was an actual blueprint for governing, with specific proposals such as term limits and a balanced budget amendment, and even actual legislation. McCarthy's vague goals are just platitudes. Want to know how Republicans will curb government spending, or pay for the 200,000 cops they pledged to put on the streets, or protect the lives of unborn children and their mothers? The document's sole reference to abortion. McCarthy won't say, perhaps because he knows the specifics would be highly unpopular. Despite the lack of specifics, the commitment says plenty, said Nicole Hammer in CNN.com. Unlike the Gingrich contract, this document makes no attempt to woo independence and focuses on wedge issues like guns, fossil fuels, and transgender athletes. There's another thing Republicans made clear, said E.J. Dionne Jr. in the Washington Post. If they gain power, they'll use it to harass the Biden administration with one hearing after another. At the rollout, Representative Jim Jordan, Republican from Ohio, was positively gleeful in promising investigations into the Afghanistan pullout, COVID's origins, and Hunter Biden. Several Republicans have been speaking of impeaching President Biden just for the fun of it. If you think things are ugly in D.C. now, just wait. And some shorter notes to round out the hour. Virginia Thomas, the wife of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, has agreed to an interview with the House January 6th committee to clear up any misconceptions. Thomas, a conservative activist, emailed state lawmakers in Arizona and Wisconsin with pleas to select Trump electors in defiance of 2020 election results and urged then White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows in text to overturn the greatest heist in our history. Murders in major U.S. cities have dropped by 4% so far in 2022 compared with the same period last year, while thefts and robberies have increased by about 20%. The murder rate still remains 30% above the level in 2019. And we'll finish with a quote from Austrian psychiatrist Viktor Frankl, who says, "Everything can be taken from a man but one thing, the last of the human freedoms, to choose one's attitude in any given set of circumstances." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.